Okay, so just having that visual of a person, it actually was a real person. Sometimes you end up even, say, over time. Of course, the Buddha is almost mythologized, and then teachers end up being pictures on walls and we get the stories, but so I thought it was helpful to say, okay, there was a person, that's how he have his yeah, just how he was. It was very warm, and also that seeing that say the monastery and his teachings really grew up out of a particular milieu. The northeast of Thailand and Theravada Buddhism, forest tradition, those are sort of the, you know, the cooking pot that brewed this particular teacher and teaching. And I think sometimes people think, well, Thai Buddhism, it's sort of like all the same, or it's one, it's actually one thing, but it really isn't. It's very, very, very diverse, say the forest tradition came out of a particular culture, very it's a rural agrarian culture, and quite poor. When I first went to train with Ajahn Chah, and then things were like taking the water out of the well, and there's no such thing as running water, or even electric pumps or things like that. It just was unheard of. And so Ajahn Chah grew up with a certain amount of, and the northeast of Thailand is probably the poorest part of Thailand, growing up with adversity, difficulty, and but there's a certain strength and stability also that came from that culture. And sort of Buddhism plays such a strong role in it. And being able to navigate the vicissitudes of life. I think and of course, on a certain level, those are very, the human condition isn't all that different, according to, like, even say the Buddha's time. You know, on a certain level, human beings haven't changed all that much. Or the northeast of Thailand, you think, wow, it's so different from modern America. And on some levels it is, but then other aspects, it's not that different. I mean, the tendency of human beings to swept up in the changing circumstances of life, birth, aging, sickness, and death, hasn't really changed that much. Greed, hatred, delusion, it hasn't really changed that much. And then having the somebody like Ajahn Chah, who was able to point a way through that. So hopefully the readings today will help to give an insight into that. I'd like to begin with just a snapshot of an event in Ajahn Chah's life. And he, at this point, he's already been a monk for about 5 or 6 years. He ordained in a village temple, and there wasn't really any examples of meditation. He hadn't really meditated yet, even, which again is sort of, you think, oh, that's what Buddhism is all about, meditation. But if you grow up in a traditional culture, then sometimes you're not exposed to it till much later in life. Yeah. And then also kind of highlight like Ajahn Chah's connection with family, because he was he's going back to visit his father who was ill. He's got news, so I'll just read this. Towards the end of that year, Lumpa received dismaying news. His father had fallen seriously ill. Lumpa's exams were to take place shortly, and if we went home now, a whole year's work would be wasted. He was doing his ecclesiastical studies and was getting good marks. He was in a good school. Should he chance it and take his exams before going home? It was no choice at all. He only had one father, and exams could wait another year. He rushed home as soon as he could to find his father's condition in steady decline. Lumpa's father, Poma, was proud to have a son in the robes, and whenever Lumpa visited home, would always encourage him in his efforts and make a request. And this is a quote, "Please don't disrobe, Venerable Sir. I invite you to remain as a monk indefinitely." This is a deliberately literal translation. It is hard to convey in the English language the tenor of a conversation between a Thai monk and his parents. Filial piety is greatly emphasized in Thai culture, and the relationship between parents and children is generally warm and close. Yet when the son becomes a monk, their way of relating to each other instantly and radically changes. The parents are now lay people. They sit on a lower seat at a respectful distance. They use monastic honorifics when referring to their son and humble personal pronouns when referring to themselves. To an observer from another culture, this formality might at first seem odd or perhaps unnatural. But for the family itself, it is simply the accepted convention. The stilted speech forms help everyone to remember that while the son's identity as a monk has not erased his identity as a member of his family, it has transformed it. Now, as he lay weak and shrunken on his deathbed, Poma made the request one last time. "You've made the right choice. Don't change it. Lay life is full of so many kinds of suffering and difficulties. There's no real peace or contentment in it. Remain as a monk." On previous occasions, Lumpa had always kept silent, his head slightly bowed, showing respect but an unwillingness to make such a commitment. This time, however, he replied, "No, I won't disrobe. Why would I do that?" His father's face relaxed into a warm, contented smile, and he drifted into sleep. When Poma discovered that Lumpa's exams would take place shortly, he urged him to return to his monastery, but this request was refused. Instead, Lumpa helped to nurse his father for the 13 more days and nights that he lingered on. It was December, when the days have a drained, subdued tone, and a cold wind blows down through Isan from China. Isan is the northeast. When first thing in the morning, everyone lights up fires outside their houses to warm themselves, and shoe kites anchored high in the sky utter their melancholy cry, "Tui tui, tui tui," throughout the night. One day at the end of the year, Paul Ma's life came to an end. And I think one of the things that, again, just trying to have Ajahn Chah as a person who, because you sometimes say, oh, you know, he's this monk, and his monk is something so different. You know, it's like, oh, they don't have parents somehow, or they don't have their normal relationships. But you know, and then I think as and it's something that everybody has to kind of work with, and as lay people living in the world, we have our family relationships, we have our parents and siblings and extended families and extended friends, and how to say establish priorities. How do we establish that in Dhamma? And it isn't as if there's a absolute correct way, but that's the Dhamma is there to inform how we try to establish and nurture those relationships or wend our way through them. So because I remember Ajahn Chah sometimes say one of the things in Buddhist tradition is, and not just tradition, it's sort of like in the Vinaya, as monks, it's one of the Vinaya rules for ordination, you have to have the permission of your parents to ordain, to leave. Or if one has married, one has to have permission from one's spouse. So that those are, one can't just sort of disappear or go into the rooms without the support of the of one's family. So even as monks, we have to establish those relationships, maintain those relationships, and. But for Westerners, sometimes at Ajahn Chah's monastery, there were Westerners showing up, and there was in those days there was no easy communication, and you're a long way away, and sometimes people showed up who wanted to ordain their parents. And would write a letter and just, you know, absolutely not. And Ajahn Chah was sort of saying, well, you have to take the sense of within also another cultural value in the West, is that if you're an adult, you make your own choices. So. And they haven't ever seen a monastery, seen the what Buddhism is. So, and better to take the ordination and to establish oneself in some kind of wholesome qualities of peace and wisdom, be able to bring that to your parents in the future. So it was a different decision, but it wasn't literal, but it was taking the circumstances so that you're Ajahn Chah's example of how to deal. It isn't exactly by a template, but it's informed by Dhamma. And as we live our own lives, and those are our choices and circumstances that we have to figure out as we go along. So the chapter on out of compassion, the Lumpa and the lay community, begins with an introduction. Appreciating the kindness and assistance that one has received in one's life and making efforts to express that appreciation in appropriate ways, and the Pali is katanyu kataveti, are, together with generosity, probably the Buddhist virtues most deeply embedded in Thai society. They are clearly apparent in relationships between sons and daughters with their parents and guardians, and in the respect paid to teachers and benefactors of any description. In Thailand, bun kun is a Thai word, the ties and obligations perceived to have been created between people by beneficial actions underlies most meaningful social intercourse, including that between members of the Sangha and the laity. In early 1954, it was the request made by a deputation of villagers led by his mother which persuaded Lumpa Cha that the time had come to establish a forest monastery near his home village. The villagers' formal invitation and Lumpa's acceptance of it reflects well the nature of the relationship between the Sangha and the laity envisioned by the Buddha. The tradition holds that any teaching by monks, even a single Dhamma talk, must always be initiated by the laity. They must want to be taught. It is for this reason that Buddhist monastics are not evangelists. They only speak Dhamma to those who have shown a sincere interest in listening to it and have asked them to teach. Like many forest monks, Lumpa had long harbored plans to eventually return to the place of his birth and propagate the Dhamma there. But it was only when he received a formal invitation from representatives of the local lay community that he felt conditions were ripe for him to do so. For Lumpa, the establishment of a monastery was the natural, almost inevitable, next step of his life as a monk. He had reached a level of practice with which he was confident there could be no regress. He was in the prime of his life, and a growing number of monks looked to him as their teacher. Furthermore, he was aware that if he was to help his mother to make progress in the Dhamma, he should not leave it for too much longer. Living as a monk, he knew that such assistance was the way, the only way, he could truly repay his great debt of gratitude to her. So that gives a certain, again, sort of setting context of the both Ajahn Chah as well as the lay relationship to the monastic form and to different monks so I thought, well, maybe does anybody have any? I don't want to get too far ahead, and sort of stop from time to time to see if there's any questions. Yeah.
Is there something you have to pass as a monastic to where the rest of the Sangha will let you form your own monastery? Is there something that's not necessarily personal but structural?
A good a good story to tell at this point is one of the monks, Western monks in our Sangha. Actually, he was here last rains retreat last summer, Ajahn Siripanyo. His father really was not up for him ordaining as a monk. He was really against it, and his father's a very successful person, a business person, and anyway, I can't believe that you're, you know, getting involved and devoting your life to organized religion. And Ajahn Siripanyo says, "Oh, Dad, you don't have to worry about that. Thai Buddhism isn't organized." I mean, there's no real procedure or, I mean, there is sometimes, but, you know, a lot of it is agreements amongst a group of monks. And if you're not a part of that, then, you're not really bound by it. And Ajahn Chah he had been training under a teacher, but he was also doing a lot of studying with other teachers, and so it wasn't really under a formal obligations. So that it was more up to his own personal feeling of, okay, he felt ready. His teacher had cautioned him for quite some time to not be teaching yet. And then there was a shift where he was wasn't against him teaching, and then this invitation from his family came. So, as one saw in the film, the lay community come to the monastery on a weekly basis for the Lunar Observance Day, and I thought I'd give a reading. Again, it's sort of the in terms of lay practice and for in Thailand, they would could easily, for the most part, easily follow, say, the lunar cycle. But many of the people who lived in town, I mean, if you lived in the countryside, it was quite easy. If you lived in town, or if you were a civil servant, then you had to follow a sort of a Western calendar. But these observance days have always, from the time of the Buddha, have formed a basis of the opportunity for the lay people to come, practice, keep precepts in the monastery, receive teachings, so that, say, here by Giri, we do that with the lunar observance days, but then also we've turned Sunday into an afternoon of practice and teaching together as well. Used to be Saturday night, but then with this new hall, I said, okay, Sunday afternoon, we've got a place to put people now, if they come. So I'd just like to read about Observance Day. The weekly Lunar Observance Day was the day that Lumpa encouraged his lay supporters to come to the monastery and receive teachings. Many would arrive in time to offer the morning meal and not leave until dawn of the following day. During this 24-hour period, Lumpo would give two Dhamma talks, one in the morning and a long, sometimes very long, one at night. During the day, people would rest, read Dhamma books, meditate, sweep leaves. Their numbers would grow in the evening as those who had been working during the day arrived. In the morning, all the lay community would formally request the 8 precepts for the duration of their stay in the monastery. This entailed, amongst other things, abstaining from food after midday, dressing in simple modest clothes, everyone wore white, and refraining from wearing makeup and jewelry. Every observance day, the monastic community would spend the whole night meditating in the Dhamma hall. The lay men and lay women would join them. Lumpa recommended that those who could not find time to go to the monastery should, nevertheless, make the observance day a day to give special attention to their actions and speech, and to devote time to reflection and inner cultivation. He advised them to refrain from all entertainments for the day, give up their evening meal, and sleep alone on the floor, using the time freed by such renunciation to study Dhamma and to meditate. If they could not manage every observance day, then they should at least try on the two big ones, the full moon and the dark moon days. And this is a quote. There are 30 days in a month. Divide them up. Give 26 to the world and 4, the half moon, full moon, and dark moon days, to the monks. For these 4 days every month, try to get to the monastery. There you can take a rest from worldly activities and keep pure sila. On these 4 days, you don't make any bad karma. 4 days, that's all. More than 4, and nobody would want to take it on. As lay people, I understand that it's normal to create bad karma at times, but the Buddha asked you to refrain for at least 4 days a month. If you find the time every month, then in 2 months, that's 8, and in a year, a lot of days. But if you make every day into a people day, an ordinary day, how are you ever going to truly flourish as a human being? How will your mind ever be radiant and know the way things are if you don't practice, if you don't make the time? It's not possible. Entering the monastery, and this is back into the comment, entering the monastery, all worldly matters were to be left outside. No gossiping about family or work or local scandals was to be tolerated. The elders were encouraged to be good examples to the younger members of the group. And this is a quote from Lumpa again. Those of you who want to smoke or chew betel nut, go outside the monastery gate. In the morning, after you've taken the 8 precepts, had your meal, listened to a Dhamma discourse, then go out and practice walking meditation. After that, you can take a short nap, but don't let it be for very long. After a suitable time, get up promptly and do some sitting meditation. Following your evening bath, go to the hall and practice sitting meditation for a while longer before evening chanting. After chanting, relax for a short while, but don't chat. This was a time to put effort into practice. And quote again. Coming to listen to a talk on Observance Day, it's not enough to simply turn up at the monastery. Just as a cloth has to be clean before it can absorb any dye, so each person coming to the monastery should prepare themselves in the right way. They should dress themselves in clean and appropriate clothing, cleanse their actions and speech, and make a determination to cleanse their mind, to make it ready to receive the Dhamma. Lumpa's Dhamma talks were eagerly awaited by the local villagers. And this is a quote from one of the villagers. Sometimes he wouldn't talk for so long. After a certain time, he would say, "From now on, pay attention to a silent discourse." And he would start to meditate there on the Dhamma seat. We'd sit there waiting, but he wouldn't say anything more. The first time, I was drowsy and wanted to sleep, but I didn't dare with him still seated up there, and so I ended up sitting right through the night. In those days, Lumpa gave marvelous talks. If you missed one of his talks, you felt hot and dry inside. You never felt bored when he spoke, even if it was something you'd heard many times before, because he always had new ways of saying it that were worth listening to. Oftentimes when people summarize or say what Ajahn Chah had, what the essence of his teaching was, or what did he focus on mostly, would be sila and samaditi, virtue and right view. And even though he was a renowned meditation master, so much of his talks were on those foundations, because for the mind to be really stable or steady or clear, the foundation of, say, of virtue, integrity, sila, and right view are really essential. And that lays a really solid base for the practice, and say mindfulness and concentration grow easily from that base. So that Ajahn Chah did spend a tremendous amount of time in his teaching to really encourage that reflective investigation of, well, what is right view, how to establish right view, what are the bases of skillful action that lay a foundation of purity of conduct, so that this next quote highlights that. Sammāditti is usually translated into English as right view. The prefix right means, I quote, in harmony with the way things are, unquote. View includes opinions, beliefs, values, theories, and philosophies. A right view is thus one that corresponds to reality. The conviction, for example, that acts of generosity lead to happiness would be considered a right view. Right view is the first constituent of the Noble Eightfold Path and is indispensable for the development of the other seven factors. At its most basic level, right view consists of the adoption of a certain number of principles, most importantly the law of karma, as basic premises or working hypotheses to be relied upon in walking the Buddhist path. On this level, it is referred to as mundane right view, the culmination of the path, an understanding of the Four Noble Truths as a direct experience, is known as transcendent right view. Unsurprisingly, given the central importance of right view as the foundation on which all Buddhist practice is to be established, teachings aimed at explaining it constituted a large proportion of Lumpa's discourses to the lay community. Right view is, he said, like the cool place unreached by the burning sun. It is our true refuge. And this is a quote. Our refuge is the mind that possesses right view. See into the heart of things. Make your view straight and correct. Then wrong views will be unable to enter into your mind and mingle with it. This is the meaning of a refuge. Suffering arises whenever there is an incorrect understanding of the way things are. Therefore, Lumbhal would emphasize establishing right view was the first step to the transcendence of suffering. This is a quote again. If your view of things is correct, if it is sammaditti, then nothing can go awry. That is to say, when your way of looking at things is in accord with the true nature of things, then you experience nothing as an obstruction. Your mind remains calm and contented, and problems are resolved. Without the effort to look closely at the mind, it is difficult to find the motivation to give up mistaken views. And this is a quote from Lumbhal again. Until then, you're like somebody who drinks alcohol. Nobody can stop such a person from drinking until he sees for himself the undesirable consequences of his habit. So here we change a mistaken view into a correct one, change evil into goodness, and change an unenlightened being into a noble one. It is right view that is responsible for these changes. These kinds of changes for the better are called merit. He said that people with wrong view had a false kind of contentment, similar to the ease of somebody who doesn't realize that they have dropped a valuable possession. Right view gave the same kind of inner ease as that experienced by somebody who remembered the exact location of a lost valuable and knew how he was going to retrieve it. Although the object was not yet in his possession, the mind was at ease. On another occasion, he compared right view to the key that opened the door to the Dhamma. Without that key, there was no way in. Questions?
There's a question from Charles of Peapod.
Oh, yeah.
He was asking, Katani Petapedi refers to receiving kindness and the recognition of the gift of kindness. How are we to understand cultivating the intention to offer kindness to others?
What was that again? Well, I think one of the things is the tangible feeling that we experience in just that willingness to be kind or to be accepting or to be solicitous to somebody else's well-being. Is in itself a quality of mind that is already, there's an experience of well-being, there's a feeling of a certain sense of happiness that's there. It's a lot easier, more easeful to be with that kind of intention than to nurse a grudge or to plot revenge on somebody. It just feels different, and so to be alert to how do we investigate and pay attention to what we actually feel, because the feeling that comes from being upset, averse, or that is, say, looking down on somebody, or is those tend to be the contracted mental states that we feel squeezed in by. We don't feel spacious. We don't feel easeful. So that offering of kindness is immediately there's a certain expansiveness of heart that's there. There's a sense of ease that is naturally felt, and it's just sort of paying attention to how it feels. So much of the that's why, say, like Ajahn Chah, as a teacher, would really try to get people to pay attention to, the experiential nature of these concepts that we're working with in terms of happiness and suffering, the experience of greed, hatred, delusion, the experience of kindness, of giving, of generosity. There's an attendant experience there that is we can know quite easily. One of the things that comes to my mind is oftentimes Ajahn Chah would be asked, how can you teach these Westerners Buddhism and Buddhist practice? You don't speak English. They don't speak Thai. And how can you teach them? And Ajahn Chah, as was often the case, he'd have a glass of warm water beside himself. He'd have a flask of warm water. He'd be sort of sipping, drinking warm water, and he sort of lifted up his glass of warm water, and he said, this is in Thai, you call this namron. He said, but here in this part of the country, they don't even call it namron, they call it namhon. It's a dialect. He said, in English, they call it hot water. In French, they call it something else. In Chinese, they call it something else. In Indian languages, they call it something else. And he said, and if you just focus on language, you won't know what it is. He said, but if you just stick your finger in it, you'll know what warm water is. And he said, the same with Dhamma. He said, Dhamma is not... it's a language of experience. It's not just the words that we use. It's the experience itself. And so gratitude and the reciprocation of gratitude, of generosity, those are they have an attendant feeling to it, and to be attuned to that, or the feeling of, say, selfishness or fear. That has a feeling to it. It's an experience that we can feel. So that these, you have a concept of, say, a Buddhist concept of katanyu kataweti, and you can There's probably books and books written about it. But it's, you know, it's pointing to a feeling of appreciation of goodness that has been done and the wish to want to reciprocate and give back from that place of goodness. And it, one can feel that in the heart. So the next thing I'd like to read is Faith in the Triple Gem, which of course is, say, fundamental to, I mean, certainly not to just lay practice, because for us all as Buddhist practitioners, whether we're living in a monastery or with a commitment to living in the world as lay people, the foundation of Triple Gem is really fundamental. And of course, our beginning of the day of this Upasika renewal day was a very explicit taking refuges and precepts and that the going for refuge to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And so I'll read this section. Since the days of the Buddha, people with faith in his teachings have declared their commitment to them by affirming three times. Buddhang saranam gacchami, I go for refuge to the Buddha. Dhammang saranam gacchami, I go for refuge to the Dhamma. Sanghang saranam gacchami, I go for refuge to the Sangha. Most simply put, taking refuge in the Buddha means looking to the Buddha as the supreme teacher of the path to peace, compassion, and wisdom. Taking refuge in the Dhamma means taking the Buddha's teachings as the supreme map of that path. Taking refuge in the Sangha means taking the enlightened disciples of the Buddha as supreme leaders on the path, examples that the path is possible to follow, and explainers of it. There's also a more profound way of understanding these three objects of refuge. Lumpa taught that the meaning of the Triple Gem has a transcendental dimension, that the three objects of refuge refer also to timeless immaterial qualities that may be realized in each person's mind. In this sense, the Buddha refers to inner awakening, the Dhamma to the way things are, and the Sangha to the right practice leading to awakening. Throughout his teaching career, Lumpa sought to encourage lay Buddhists to go beyond a merely superficial affiliation with their religion, expressed in material support for the monastic order and ritual observances. His concern was that they should learn how to use the Buddha's teachings to reduce suffering and increase the quality of their lives. He did this by bringing the teachings down to earth, expressing them in the vernacular, and revealing them as tools to be used in daily life, rather than as objects of reverence. This strategy is clearly revealed in the way that Lumpa spoke about the three refuges. He emphasized that, quote, Buddha does not only refer to the founder of the religion who, some 2,500 years ago, lived in India, as it was his realization of the Dhamma that transformed Siddhartha Gautama into the Buddha, his Buddha nature and the Dhamma were one and the same thing. To quote, when you see the Dhamma, you see the Buddha, and all your doubts vanish. The Buddha is the Dhamma. The Dhamma is the Buddha. The historical Buddha did not take enlightenment with him. He left it right here. Therefore, as the Dhamma is timeless, Lumpa insisted it is still as accessible to one who follows the Buddha's teachings as it ever was. Quote again, The Buddha is still present today. The Buddha is the truth. The truth is always present. No matter who is born and who dies, the truth remains the same. It never disappears from the world. It's always here in exactly this way. Seeking to express this idea to a group of teachers, he drew an analogy. There is a body of knowledge and skills that, once mastered, allows people to make a living as a teacher. People become teachers for a number of years and then retire. But the knowledge and skills that made them teachers remain. So, quote, similarly, the truth that makes a human being a Buddha still exists. It hasn't disappeared. Two Buddhas are born. One is physical and the other immaterial. As for the true Dhamma, the Buddha said, Ananda, keep practicing. You will thrive in the Dhamma Vinaya. Whoever sees the Dhamma sees me. Whoever sees me sees the Dhamma. How could that be? It sounds as if the Buddha and the Dhamma are being mixed up and made into the same thing. Actually, to begin with, there was no Buddha. The Buddha could only be called by the name of Buddha when he realized the Dhamma. Before that, he was Prince Siddhartha. It's like all of you. Now you're just unenlightened village folk. But if you were to realize the true Dhamma, then you'd be exactly the same as the Buddha. There would be no difference. So understand this point, all of you, right now. The Buddha is still present. Lumpa found the belief, originating in scholarly circles, that it is no longer possible in the present day and age to realize enlightenment to be a pernicious one. He spoke grimly of the kamma created by scholars who criticize those putting effort into practice of the teachings as wasting their time. He considered the holders of such a view like fools who conclude that because they can see no water beneath their feet, that there can be none beneath the earth they stand on. It's a quote. To put it simply, practice is like digging a well. In the Buddha's time, they dug down into the earth in order to find water. When they met roots or rocks, they removed them, and eventually they reached water. There was no need to create the water. All they had to do was dig the well to access it. In the present day, you can dig a well in order to get water in exactly the same way. Whenever you get down to the water-bearing strata, you'll find water. So I think that's an important aspect of Ajahn Chah's teaching, encouragement of his teaching to the lay community, that they this teaching of truth is timeless. It's a here and now Dhamma. It's to be experienced each wise person for themselves. I mean, this is what we chant in our chanting, and that is. To be remembered, recollected, and internalized, because it's easy to sort of, it's too difficult, or it's for somebody else who's doing the real practice somewhere or somehow. But it's just that encouragement to recognize this truth is just, it's always been here, and all we need to do is put forth the effort, utilize the teachings in a skillful way. And it's accessible to us, and I think that image of digging a well is really, really apt. And the water is it's in the earth if you dig in the right spot and you use the right tools, and you can have, you can access that water. And in the same way that we can access the truth that the Buddha is pointing to, that is a liberating, it's a liberating truth. It liberates us from suffering. It has that capacity to liberate the heart from suffering. So, and again, it's sort of that aspect of, oh, this is what going for refuge is about. This is, we take a refuge, we seek refuge in these Buddha Dhamma and Sangha as a means to access these transcendent truths, transforming truths. How are we doing? Questions?
Yeah. I'm a mystical. Did you mention what the transcendent truth of the Sangha was?
Yeah, the one is, when you say transcendent truth, it's the right practice leading to awakening. So it's when we on a conventional level, it's taking refuge in, say, those awakened beings who are who have realized the fruits of the path. And but then, as a transcendent, say, object of refuge, then it's pointing to these, say, a timeless quality that of practice, that this is the practice which anybody can follow. So that, and then even when we say Sangha as refuge, then it's pointing to those who have realized the fruits of the practice. And that's when you say, like a conventional sangha, then it's having robes and the gear is part of sangha. That is a conventional aspect, but it's what the Buddha is pointing to is, like, when we do the chant and the evening chanting, morning chanting. And recollecting the Supatipanna Bhagavato Savaka Sangha, the Sangha is those disciples who have practiced well. In that chant, then it's the four pairs, the eight kinds of beings. People often think, what are these four pairs, eight kinds of beings? But that's the four pairs are the those who have realized path and fruit of stream entry, once returning, non-returning, arhatship. So those are the, I'm saying, noble insights transcendent fruits of the path. As a quality, then it is this. There is this practice that we all can be engaged in. Yeah.
As lay people being engaged in practice, in which I appreciate the right here distinction between transcendent and transformative. That's really helpful for me. Mm-hmm. Transformative is really helpful, that word. And Ajahn Chah acknowledging that lay people are going to make bad karma as ordinary in their lives. Do you feel that as lay people refining the way that we keep the five precepts is sufficient or fruitful in terms of transforming from making that karma?
Well, you know, I think it's important to recognize that really all practice rises out of those five precepts as a base. Even like, you know, 227 precepts of a Buddhist monk, they're not completely different. They rise up out of those principles of the five precepts, because there is the commitment to non-harming, to trustworthy qualities, to mindfulness, and so that all went their extrapolations, but the kind of the essence is in the five precepts. So it isn't sort of the number that's important. It's the quality of attention and the intention that we bring to it that again allows for that transformation. And to a certain degree, those five precepts, as we commit to them, understand them more clearly, recognize how they're informing our well-being, then a certain commitment to training and a relinquishment naturally manifests. So that those five precepts are not. It's easy to sort of say, well, they're just five precepts, you know. But because I can count it on one hand. No big deal. But once you start refining how you relate to them, then those aspects compassion and honesty, commitment to truth, those start to shine, and then our conduct changes, but then our heart changes as well. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And some of them Buddhism, one thing about Buddhism that attract me a lot in practice, a very practical practice, daily routine to liberate your soul, your mind, so you can find peace of this present life, after life.
Right.
You know that. So as a master monk that you are, what do you face with kind of meditation? I know Buddha advisor, living this life, you believe in yourself and practice. But then the people that they didn't have a chance to practice, what do you offer them so they can have some hope, so they can go in peace?
A lot of it one is being present for them, be willing to listen to them, to comfort them in some way, to help them, to be kind to them. Those are very human qualities that don't that don't need a Buddhist label put on it, and so that the for people who are approaching the end of their life, you know, I think the, and of course we all are, but particularly when there is a terminal illness, then it is in your face. And so that being able to be patient with people, to be kind to them, to be gentle with them, so that it's something that is tangibly soothing to them, settling. So trying to be a calm, settling presence to them, as opposed to trying to teach them Buddhism. It's just, that's usually not very useful at that time. And I think also not being, because sometimes like that experience of as death comes closer, if somebody doesn't have much of a refuge, it's easy to be to experience fear and to not be, say, ruffled or shaken by somebody else's fear, and to be able to be calm and settled within that. That helps them to experience a sense of calm. That's a gift that you can give to them. That makes sense? Well, sometimes I don't say anything. But I think also, especially when somebody is dying and facing death, then it's important to not say something that is superficial or just canned. You really have to speak from the heart, and so that's where you tap into this kindness, compassion, acknowledgement of their suffering or difficulty, and being willing to hear them, to be present for them, to not be shaken by it. Because oftentimes it brings up our own fear, so then that we can learn about our own fear of death by being close to people who are experiencing that. Say, oh, okay, there's still something there, and how can I be comfortable with that, and then how can I be a presence for their well-being. But sometimes also I find, especially as monks, it's one of the things that is helpful in terms of just being a presence, is also like a chanting. Even if somebody is not Buddhist, oftentimes it's that using a chanting to, again, it's something that's quite soothing, and as a and as an expression of loving kindness, compassion. It's like just chanting the Metta Sutta in English, or is the words are really meaningful, and the one using the chanting as a way to the sound of it, the cadence of it, the rhythm of it, can be very soothing, and that can be quite helpful sometimes.
Thinking about the precepts as a basis for these transformational processes, on one hand I can think of the precepts as very straightforward. These are things that I'm striving not to do.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, I feel like there's an evolution with them, especially with right speech.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm doing pretty well, but then I'll find myself regretting things. Oh, okay, so then I evolve a little bit. And the longer I'm on the precepts, the more I realize there's quite a ways to go. Can you talk about this a little bit, about your understanding of in this sense of evolution or growth within the precepts, as opposed to them just being very fundamental?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think there is a... there's a certain maturing of our own ability to hold the precepts, but also, in particular, how to understand the precepts. Because it's easy to relate to precepts as rules. If I can just keep the rules somehow. And I mentioned it briefly this morning of what we translate as precept is the Pali word sikapada, sikapadam, and literally like pada means foot, so like the foundation, the basis, and sika is to study, to learn, or to educate. So that this precept is a foundation for learning and studying. Studying what? Studying about ourselves, studying about life, studying about the world around us, and what makes people happy, what makes people suffer. So one starts to investigate. Well, what are refinements of this? What are extrapolations of this? What are ways that I can refine this? How can I hold this skillfully? How do I create suffering out of this? What happens when I don't keep it? Because it isn't a matter of, oh, if I just get the rules all right, then I'll be okay. Because we can still create suffering for ourselves by doubting whether we've kept it properly. Or even if we have, we start second-guessing ourselves. So that sense of self starts getting in there. And you say, well, hey, wait a minute, why is that? So then you're starting to understand how the mind responds to when you have a boundary, you're able to reflect something back, and we have to learn from that, because what's reflecting back is oftentimes our own worries, our own desires, our own fears, our own sense of who I am, because I keep or don't keep a precept, and all of that is those are all aspects of precepts of sila, but they're nuances that and refinements that you start to really learn from. Yeah.
We all want happiness, and we all want to avoid suffering, and it seems like there's a razor's edge. Because you can find happiness and then you have the hope that you won't lose it and the fear that you will lose it. And how do you How do you peel away the hope and the fear and bathe in the happiness?
You just keep suffering. Well, you start recognizing, and it sounds trite, but it's true, in the sense that you start recognizing, even with a good intention, man, I suffered over that too. It's one more aspect. Oh, I need to understand that. I have to learn that. I have to let go of that. That's another, look what crept in there. I have to get some clarity around that. So that's attuning to the nuances of suffering, and not in the sense of I have to be in abject misery, but it's sort of that rippling of the mind that happens sometimes, or the kind of where the mind gets shaken because of something, or when gets worried or fearful about something. That in itself is even doing something good, then we say, oh, we can still make a problem over it. Yeah. And so it's just being able to be willing to recognize that and bring it back and investigate it. So, that's a, I can let go of that too. Yep.
What qualifies as helping a parent make progress on the path?
There's many aspects to that. I mean, in the sense of being almost like being a resource of knowledge for a parent, in the sense that one is trying to practice oneself, trying to cultivate wholesome qualities and understanding oneself that one can share with parents. But it's also, it's important how one does that as well. Especially with parents, they have to be interested, some insufferable child comes and tells you what's right, and it's a good way to turn them off. But see, for them to be able to see that you are happier, more content, more grounded. That opens up conversations that are really important, and so that's the way that one can sort of teach. It's not just by that's really helping parents and giving parents is sort of like. You want to be almost like dangling the carrot out. Is it? This is really good, and then they take an interest. Michael. Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the things with regret is. Because there's a wholesome regret, a wholesome remorse, and then there's guilt, which is, they're really two different things. And it's important to, because sometimes they, they seem the same, and but for especially in Buddhist practice, then you know, there's an important quality to be able to recognize unskillful actions or qualities, and to, you know, to recognize them, acknowledge them, and having regret, but then using it as a catalyst for change and a wholesome determination to be better in the future, or to establish oneself in what is what's truly skillful. And then, but then there is an interesting dynamic in the Western psyche of guilt, which years and years ago I was traveling with a very senior monk, and we were in New Zealand, and we led chanting, meditation, Dhamma talk, and after the Dhamma talk, there were questions, and one of the questions was how to work with guilt. And then I went to translate the question, and by that time I was pretty fluent in Thai. But then I burst out laughing because I realized I didn't know what the Thai word for guilt was, and then what I had to do was explain to him what a Western person does to make themselves feel guilty, and he listened. He was very concerned look in his face. He said, "Oh, tell them not to do that. That's suffering." So I mean, there's an appropriate place for regret and remorse. That clear acknowledgement of, "Oh, that was unskillful. It was inappropriate," but also, but taking it and using it as a motivator for, now I've got a clear sense of what's really beneficial, what's really right, and because there's a certain. Now, there's a certain element in our kind of collective psyche that if I make myself feel bad enough about something, then I'm doing the right thing. It has a twisted logic to it, but it also is important to recognize that, yeah, there are some actions that they don't just disappear because of they resonate through the mind and the heart over time, and of course that's what, say, like the nature of kamma. Oftentimes you think in terms of kamma, and there's this sort of mystical concept of kamma and results of kamma, and sort of, well, it's not that strange or mystical. You actually have to remember what you did, and some things you just, it'd be best not to have to remember it, not to set those conditions in place. But then when they are there, then it's sort of acknowledging it, and then setting up an opposite and wholesome intention. That's where the Buddha points to the cultivation of loving kindness, the power of loving kindness as a basis for undermining it's like karmic patterns that are in place, and that loving kindness, cultivation of metta bhavana is very powerful for that kind of transformation of karmic patterns that bring suffering. And so it's a helpful recollection. Special way to develop. There's different, many ways of cultivating loving kindness, but most of that's around technique or method. Most important thing is the feeling in the heart itself. Is how do I bring about a sense of kindness, acceptance, warmth, forgiveness? Those are all certain qualities that help to cultivate that quality of loving kindness. And those are, so it's like attuning to the actual feeling in the heart, and trying to find skillful ways of lifting those qualities of warmth and forgiveness, acceptance, kindness. So those are embodied. Why don't we have a break? I think everybody's ready for a break. And say 15 minutes and back in here.